difficult when you realize that you are not the daughter so much anymore, or the son, as the case may be. You are the caregiver, and your role changes, your perspective changes. It's very, very difficult when you just want your mom, you know, yeah. or you just want your dad.
Sure.
And they can't be there for you in the same way they were when you were younger and when they were healthy.
How do you find joy in life's difficult moments? Life is full of challenges, both big and small. Come explore some sticky moments with the women of Reed Memorial and be inspired to find, keep, and share joy in life's journey. On behalf of Reed Memorial, join me, Joy Maple, for our podcast study and helpful resource page to encourage you to find joy in life's sticky moments.
I am so glad that you're here with us for this episode of Finding Joy in Life's Sticky Moments. Today's guest is a pastor, and I don't know about you, but I've always thought that pastors, you know, must have a pretty perfect life. There's no trials or tribulations because they just seem to walk a little bit closer to God, right? Well, today's guest is our associate pastor. She's been with Reed Memorial for 4 years, and she is an incredibly faithful woman who not only has a great sense of humor, but can empathize with all of those folks going through a sticky moment. So let's welcome our pastor, Reverend Nadine Ellsworth Moran.
Hi, Joy. Thank you for having me on the podcast today.
I am so excited that you're here. Everybody may not know you, so tell them a little bit about yourself.
Well, I am a native of Charlotte. I was born there, grew up there. I did go away to colleges, but mostly North Carolina until I went overseas to do my first graduate degree. Then I came back and I did not go into ministry. My first degree was not in anything related to religion. And I came in and worked at the district attorney's office in Charlotte. It was my first real adult job. And then I was able to work for private law firms after that and became trained as a paralegal. And that took me to Washington, D.C., and then back to Charlotte, where I ended my law career, as it were, was when I was working at a smaller firm, and I was doing estate planning and probate. And that's kind of dovetailed with where my spiritual life was going. I found that there were so many people who were facing end-of-life decisions. They were trying to plan. These are difficult decisions and things to talk about in general. And then on the other side of it, after someone has passed away, sitting across the table from somebody in a conference room in a law firm, you cannot offer them spiritual comfort. You can tell them what they need to do. You can give them the practical advice they need, but you can't really speak to them about what's going on with them emotionally or spiritually. So that was my nudge, a big part of my nudge from God to go to seminary. And I ended up going to Union Presbyterian Seminary in Charlotte.
So were you always a faithful person? And was this just kind of circling you back to that? Or was it something that you just felt a calling and it was kind of a new thing for you?
I had always been very curious about religion, even as a child, but from a young age, I felt very comfortable with my faith. I felt very secure in my faith. Now, I was not your youth group kid. I did not do youth group at all. I participated in church in other ways. I loved Sunday school classes. I loved worship. I actually went to a different church than my parents went to. They allowed us, my brothers and I, to choose if we wanted to go to church and where we wanted to go to church. So I actually went to a different church than my parents. They would drop me off and then they would go to their church.
So 13 and going to worship by yourself. That is quite impressive, Nadine. So how did you choose this church? So tell me a little bit more about this preacher.
Well, he was on TV, I just really appreciated his sermons. There was always something that spoke to me and I thought about, and I really just wanted to be part of that congregation. I wanted to be there as he was preaching.
That is amazing. Yeah. Wow. And okay.
I was a member of that church up until my early 20s.
And you found a great sense of community there. You didn't feel like, okay, I'm the only late teenager hanging out in this church.
I was pretty independent, to be honest. So I was happy just to be there. I did get to know some people, but it ended up being a mega church. It was not when I joined. So that kind of changed the dynamic for me. So yeah, when it was smaller, yes, I went to Sunday school. I made friends there. As it grew, it kind of grew beyond what I was comfortable with as far as community. It literally became a mega church at one point, and it's still an active church today. That pastor has long since retired, but it was a wonderful experience for me because it was not the denomination that I serve currently. Wow. It was a different denomination. I got a lot from it, and it certainly shaped how my understanding of my faith and even of different perspectives came into play. So it was a good experience for me, and I'm grateful to my parents that they let me do that.
So you had this nudging in your law field, mm-hmm. and you know, kind of maybe, and then this history that you have. So you went back to seminary, mm-hmm. of course, because like you said, it's in your backyard. Yeah. Okay. So were you married at the time? Was your husband going, what? Wait, whoa. Because like all these years in this law field, you know, and all of a sudden going seminary is a different turn.
My husband did not marry a minister. And while he says he was not surprised, I still don't think it was like he was expecting it to happen. I had gotten at that point very involved in my church that I was at. I had joined since leaving the church, my childhood church, sort of, so to speak. I left and went to a Presbyterian church, PCUSA, and that was sort of my youngest days church, was a PCUSA church. And I loved that church, and I began teaching, and I think that was a real way God was really pushing me, because I would teach Sunday school, and I ended up kind of being a permanent Sunday school teacher for years. And then I was like on every committee you could imagine, and Presbyterian women.
So you're thinking, I might as well get paid for this.
Well, luckily, one of the associate pastors, who I had, you know, of course, gotten to know pretty well through all these activities, said, you know, you should think about seminary. And I was like, I don't know. I'm staying pretty busy, you know, with church right now. This seems pretty good for me. And then one day she came in with a brochure for the Charlotte campus of the seminary, which was new at the mm-hmm. time. And she just kind of slid it across the table. And it was like, what are you going to say now? And I'm like, because I had said I didn't want to, you know, couldn't move
travel
away, right? Mm-hmm. Couldn't move out of town. My family was, you know, in Charlotte. I needed to be close to my parents, et cetera. I had a lot of good excuses. And then she was like, well,
it's in your backyard. You must go. So you did.
So yeah, God had the last word for sure. Because I was like, okay, I can't really argue with a seminary that is, you know, 15 minutes away. So there it was. But I had to keep working. So I went to seminary on the weekends. It was a commuter based program. It was designed for people like me who were second career or could okay. not leave their current work situation financially, couldn't do it, and then would go to seminary on the weekends. So it's a long process, and you give up your weekends for years. You got to be pretty sure this is your calling.
Pretty committed.
And your
for
family
sure.
has to be on board with this. So it was my husband was gratefully very much a supporter and on board and a great strength for me during this time. And it was during this time that my sort of sticky moments were starting to happen as well. Just the pressure of seminary is one thing, but then you have job and seminary studies. And then for me, I also had the situation of my parents' health started to decline greatly during this time.
Where are you in the lineup? In your siblings?
Oh, I am the youngest and the only girl.
Oh, the baby.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. And so how old were your parents at this time that you were going through seminary and trying to work Goodness. And all this?
They are about 10 years apart in age. My mother is actually older than my father. So my mother was probably, I guess, in her mid-70s, maybe, And so that made my father about mid-60s.
Yeah. So their health begins to decline. And are you the only sibling or only child of your parents that is local that could help out? Or how did that work?
Well, part of it was I was the most comfortable doing certain things. My father had had some major surgeries. I was the only one who wasn't queasy packing a wound. I have garnered great appreciation for anyone in the medical field because I'm like, okay, I can do this because it's my father, but you know, if you can do this and this is your calling, I praise you because it's not easy. So that was one reason because it kind of started with my father's operation to start with. And my mother had kind of had chronic conditions that were just worsening. One of my siblings does live in Charlotte, but is an airline pilot. So
not always around.
Not always around. And of course, had his own family. My eldest brother works overseas and is seldom home. So it kind of was that I was the most available. Now, not to say that my brothers didn't pitch in when they could, but
sure,
for just logistical and practical reasons, I was kind of the one who was now in charge of parent care.
Well, and how did you feel? Because, you know, I can speak from a little bit of that experience. My parents were older and are older, and turning the tables and becoming a caregiver to your parents, that's really challenging and just sometimes emotionally gut-wrenching.
It is very difficult when you realize that you are not the daughter so much anymore, or the son, as the case may be. You are the caregiver, and your role changes, your perspective changes. It's very, very difficult when you just want your mom, you know, yeah, or you just want your dad.
Sure.
And can't be there for you in the same way they were when you were younger and when they were healthy. And that's a huge adjustment to make mentally. You get very frustrated with one another. There's just so much that is happening. And you have to develop the ability to see things from their perspective. Because just from my perspective, I was like, well, why can't you just accept this? You know, or why can't you just see that this is here to help you? Or I'm setting these things up for you. And then to have it all fall apart. You want that same relationship you had before.
But it's morphing into something different. And there's a little, I think, from what you're saying, grief in that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you're kind of mourning before they're gone, or that the relationship is changing. And that responsibility that you now have is something that you may not really want.
Right.
It's such a burden.
It can be.
But it's such a loving thing, too. Like, you love your parents, so you want the best for them, and you want to help them. And then I think for parents, I don't know if yours are like this, but I know a little bit of mine didn't want to relinquish their independence, but they didn't realize you're not healthy enough mm-hmm. to do this independently. So,
absolutely. All of those things are true. One of the big things is the question of independence. You know, as I personally don't have children, but obviously know that you raise your children to become independent. And when your parent is losing independence, you're having to help them adjust to the fact that you can't drive anymore.
Oh.
Or, you know, I'm going to have to handle your finances for you because you're forgetting to pay some bills. These things, you know, for us seem to be practical. Them, it is a loss of independence as an adult who has lived through decades of their own life, their own nuclear family, and then raising their own families and work and all of the things that go into building a life. And suddenly, their life has shrunk down to a very small place. COVID might have helped us understand that in some strange ways, because the idea that you couldn't really leave your house that much in the beginning. You know, you had to depend on people to bring you stuff, right? You couldn't just go. Now, if you're of sound mind and body, you knew as soon as, you know, we were given okay, you could go out. But imagine if you couldn't.
Exactly.
That's what it's like for someone who's aging and suddenly realizes they can't just go to, you know,
pick up some milk.
Right, can't just go pick up some milk. Can't just go walk at the mall and window shop. Can't just do the regular everyday things that we all do without thinking. And suddenly, you know, they don't even have a car anymore.
Oh, that's so tough.
You have to call somebody.
And how during this time when things are their world is getting smaller and smaller, how did you and your brothers negotiate amongst each other? You know, who's going to be the caregiver? Who's going to be the one to handle this or that? And were you all on the same page, or did that take a moment, even, you know, when you're not all together in the same city? I'm sure that made it even more challenging.
It depends a lot on your family dynamic going in. I was very fortunate that my brothers and I were on the same page. We all agreed. Now, I will say my eldest brother, because he simply physically was not there and couldn't see some of these things for himself, you know, wondered if, you know, were we moving too quickly in putting some of these things in place? But when he was able to come and see our parents, realized, yes, these are necessary. Things were, you know, things were bad. If you have any tensions in your sibling relationships, it's, I hate to say, probably going to get worse before it gets better, because you're going to have different opinions about what to do or what not to do. Or, and this is very common, you want to do what your parent is asking you to do. You know, you want to give them the best possible life and the best quality of life. But sometimes what they're asking for or want to do is not in their best interest, or isn't something they can actually physically do, but they haven't faced that reality yet. And so if you have one sibling who's still encouraging them to do these things and another sibling who's saying this is not really realistic anymore, then you're going to butt heads. So it's that can add stress upon stress. So I do encourage families, especially if you've got siblings who are all local or close together, who are going to try to be working together, to sit down and really talk to one another and say, look, we all love our parents. How do we help them as a united front? Because it will be twice as hard if one sibling is doing one thing and another sibling is doing another, and they're at odds with one another. I was fortunate that my brothers and I were willing to trust one another with decisions, and that we would sit down and talk and say, hey, here's the situation. You'll also find if you're not living with your parents, which I imagine most people who are
not
my age, you know, or, you know, even whenever this begins to happen, they're not going to tell you stuff. Just know they are not going to tell you that they've been sick or they've taken a fall. Sometimes you don't even know they've been to the hospital until after the fact.
And you're like, what?
Yes. Uh-huh. So I tell people, you know, be prepared. They will keep things from you. They don't want you to, A, they don't want you to worry. Oh, I didn't want to worry you. B, they do not want to be a burden. This is a thing you will hear many, many times. I heard many times, I don't want to be a burden to you. I'm like, you are my parent. I'm pretty sure I was a big old burden to you
for a long time.
You know, it's kind of the least we can do. And that is where some of the faith elements come in. You know, how do we honor our mother and father? How do we care for them? How do we treat them with the love and respect that we would want to be treated with? So you have to keep those things in mind as well. It's like, no, this is how I will honor you, by taking care of you.
Going back for just a second in your story, you've got your day job. You've got your side job, which is going to school for seminary. Okay. And then you have this husband. And so where are you finding time to take care of mom and dad? Are you going after work? Are you going after class on Saturday? I mean, how did that work? And were you just so frazzled and just done?
Oh, yes. And yes.
And yes. And yes. And yes.
For a while. Luckily, my parents' house was on my way to work. So I began working at the seminary. So that helped.
Ooh, one thing off the list.
So while I still had a job, I worked full time at the seminary, but then I was also a student. So it was at least in one place. So I will add that. But it was on the way. Their house was on the way to work. So I would stop in the morning at my lunch break. Luckily, close enough, I could check in really quick most days, you know, just run in, make sure they had something to, you know, eat, everybody was doing okay, and then stop on the way home. Well, that's a lot, you know, especially having to do the midday stop. So there was a period where my father was in the hospital for an extended stay for several months. And so my mother could not be left alone. So I had to move into the house with them. So I'm away from my husband in my home life, and I'm sleeping on a couch for a couple of months, you know, and then I have my father who's, you know, alone in the hospital because my mother can't go visit him. And then that's when other things start to come to the forefront because my father handled the finances.
Oh, so she didn't know how to do all that, right? Or wasn't familiar with the routine of things.
Exactly. So now I'm stepping in to handle finances. There are just so many things that will start to come up. One other thing, you know, that was very helpful that my parents did, and I certainly encourage everyone, even no matter what your age is, actually, but to have estate planning documents, to have a power of attorney, to have a healthcare power of attorney, but to have a financial power of attorney. I was that person. It was in my background, right?
I was just going to say, the Lord works in really funny ways, Nadine. Yes. You know, the estate background, then the seminary. I mean, isn't his timing and everything perfect?
I know. So when we sat down with the estate attorney, you know, she's going over things with my parents and she's like, do you understand this? I'm like, all too well. But not everybody's going to understand what is a trust. What are these documents? What do we really need? So, you know, sit down with your parents, sit down with your family, and you really have to talk it through. It's not something people want to talk about.
Sure.
They don't want to plan for their, you know, days when they're gone, but it is such a gift if you have these things in place. And even with some of these things in place, because my mother was still living, but her cognitive ability was declining.
Sure. Okay.
She was still listed on these documents as being the person who could go and do these things, but she really couldn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, a simple trip to the bank would take 2 hours.
Stars. Wow.
Yeah. So these are things that you can't really prepare yourself for in many ways. You can't prepare yourself for the emotional, the grief that you mentioned, the frustration, the exhaustion, pure and simple exhaustion that will come with this. But there are some practical things you can do that will help pave the way. So it's not quite as much going on at one time. It's like, okay, we have this in place. Let me just look at these documents and see what I need to do.
When things weren't going so great and dad was in the hospital and mom wasn't doing so well and you had to move in, was there ever a point where you thought, all right, maybe we need like professional care in the house or we need assisted living or something like that? Did y'all have that debate as a family?
Yeah, this is where the sticky comes in. And I have heard this repeated with many other people in church and friends and in all situations. So I think this is pretty common. What happens is the family caregiver, whether it's the spouse or a child, in this case, sometimes, you know, my father was, you know, the able body
still was cognitively
there. Still cognitive, mm-hmm. But it was wrecking his health. He already had some health issues of his own. Being the full-time caregiver for my mother was diminishing his health as well. So then it just compounds. So now one or both of them are constantly in need of serious, you know, attention. That is a difficult conversation to have with a parent to say, I can't be here all the time. You may meet with some resistance because the parent wants the child to be the one to take care of them.
Sure.
Right? And you want to do it. But the reality of family, job, other things, if you're in school or whatever you might have else that's going on, you can't generally just drop everything and move in indefinitely and be the full-time caregiver. That's pretty rare.
Was that hard for you to put up your hand and say, I love you, but I can't do it like we're doing it?
It was hard. And I think for me, I mean, I kind of had to hit the floor where I was like, I physically can't do this anymore. You reach a point where you physically can't go on, you know, and, you know, your spouse or your friends are like, honey, you know.
We haven't seen you in months. What's going on, girl?
And, you know, you look terrible. You know, it's like, I feel terrible.
You're like, thanks.
I mean, and you get to the point where you're just like, yeah, I know. I feel the way I look. And you have to have that hard conversation to say, look, I wish I could do this. I want to be the person who's here for you all the time, but I can't be. And neither could my brothers, you know, right? Even, you know, even with two of us in town,
it just wasn't enough.
It's not enough, you know, and there's, you know, mitigating factors on all sides. So, like, you know what? Let's start looking at some help to come in, which you may or may not get agreement on at first. Or you might get agreement on it first until the person actually shows up.
And they're like, we don't like him or her.
Right. Be prepared that there is not going to be immediate joyful acceptance of a stranger coming into your house.
How many people did y'all have to let go before you got to somebody?
Oh, mercy. So, you know, we worked with an agency and we had, you know, regular people who came in pretty much every day for a while. And we had meals delivered. I mean, we had everything. And then one by one, they would get undone.
Nadine, during all this, and you're exhausted, you're burning the candle at every end, how did you take care of yourself? And how did you find this joy in this very sticky, dark time?
That's a great question. It's not easy, but you do have to take care of yourself. You really, really do. I think new mothers do this too. There's a lot of parallels between taking care of a
baby,
an infant, and taking care of an older person. Now, the caution is not to infantilize your parents. You know, they're still adults who earned your respect and love, and you need to keep that in mind. However, there's a lot of similarities in the fact that if one of them was sleeping, I was going to sleep. Grab that sleep when you can. Work with a sibling or work with a friend or even your church, you know, your deacons. If your church has deacons, somebody might be able or willing to just come hang out with a parent for a couple of hours so you can do some other things. Make time to see your friends. Just do something fun.
All right. I just want to know, Nadine, in this little tidbit of advice, how good on a scale of 1 to 10 were you at doing this? I mean, was this something you developed over time, or was it something you just hit a wall and you were like, I can't keep doing it this way? And you decided, okay, I've got to approach this different. Or was it something, you know, slow and steady and you just developed?
It kind of creeps up. I mean, it crept up on me because at first you don't realize, at least I didn't, how much time you're spending in this caregiving role. And then until it kind of takes over, and the spousal support is huge, I must say. And props to my husband, for he was a saint with just spending time, you know, just coming in and just spending time talking to my mother or father or just hanging out with them. Their lives become kind of insular. And even if your parents have a lot of friends, you know, they've kind of closed off.
Well, and chances are their friends are of similar age, yes, with similar health issues, and so they may not be able to get to them. So it kind of depends on your friends who are willing to come right, kind of quasi-visit you while you're with your parents.
Exactly, exactly. So I did work with my sibling, the one who lived locally. When he was in town, I learned to just say,
your turn.
It is your turn. Mm-hmm. And he would graciously step in, or his wife would step in, you know, and they have a child with disability. So it wasn't like they could easily walk away.
Sure. They had a full plate as well.
They had a full plate as well.
Was there any guilt or feeling terrible that you took that break? I mean, did you feel like, oh, I really probably should be there?
I didn't really feel that guilt, because at that point they're with my brother. I'm like, now the guilt comes when not a family member.
Yeah, when you're paying for that person to sit there. Yeah.
Right, right. There's, I don't know if this is appropriate for your podcast, but I always think of an episode of Frasier where they're trying to figure out what to do with their father because he's having these problems because he's been shot in the hip, you know.
Yes.
And so one brother brings out all the facilities, you know, that can care for them. And it says, we care so you don't have to. and Frasier is like, it doesn't say that. And Niles is like, well, it might as well. You
know? Right.
Well, you kind of feel that way when you're looking at these things. If you're looking at nursing home care or you're looking at retirement home facilities, you do kind of feel like, am I shuffling my parents off for their benefit or for my own? But it's also just coming to that realization that I can't do this alone and it's too much for me.
Well, and the other thing that I think about the story and I think about it in my own family life is just knowing that this journey is not going to get any easier.
No.
It's not like a parent having a newborn who goes, ooh, they're going to get more and more independent. Mm-hmm. They're going to be able to tie their own shoes and feed themselves and bathe themselves. No, that's going to get worse and worse. And the ability to do independently is going to get smaller and smaller. And so long term, how do you address all that? And how do you feel about all that?
That's another really sticky moment because you are facing your parents' mortality. I mean, they are literally often physically diminishing. You know, your mom or dad is not that tall, you know, strong person. Mm-hmm. You know, you see them in a hospital bed and they are small. They are not the same as they were. But inside, there is that person that you know and love and who loves you. And remembering that person is still in there, even if their outward actions may seem different or they're on certain medications and it makes them cranky or they're in constant pain. We forget that.
True. During this time where she's in this pain and you see her demise and things aren't going well, did you do anything with your mother to kind of keep things light and joyful and the spirit between you all, not just one of, I'm here to, you know, feed you, I'm here to take care of you. Did you get to be her daughter?
Yes. And I verbalized that at some point. And I think that's important to say, I'm not here to do the laundry or make lunch or whatever else. I'm just here to hang out with you and be your daughter. And luckily, my mother's humor stayed intact.
That's awesome. Much,
yeah, until the end. So my mother had a very sharp sense of humor and we would watch, you know, old shows. I mean, I just remember watching Gunsmoke with her.
Quality programming.
But she would come out with these zingers, you know, about Marshall Dillon. And I would just crack up because I'm like, this is my mother. You know, this is the woman who just...
This is what you want to remember.
Yeah. And just take advantage of those moments where, you know, things are okay. They may not be great, but they're okay. And everybody's, you know, kind of together and talking and just, you know, and talk to your parents. Ask them questions. Ask them about their lives before, you know, you were born. You don't know that much about your parents sometimes as you think you do.
Sure.
You only know from the time you were aware.
Right. Until now. Until today.
Until that point. So, you know, just talking to them, asking questions, looking at old photos. There's a lot of joy to be had. And just to find those moments, but to really intentionally have those times where you're like, I am not here as a caregiver. We're just hanging out. We're just going to talk. We're having fun today. Or we're just going to go sit outside in the garden and enjoy, you know, being outside and listening to the birds. So just finding whatever it's possible to do that gives you both enjoyment and you can be in that moment together and not as anything but parent and child.
As this journey went on, and how long did it last before you lost your parents?
Oh, gosh. My mother's decline was over a very long period of time. But let's see, when I graduated seminary in 2011, my mother died in 2015. So, I mean, we're talking years. I mean, this is years of decline. During that time, my father's health was always up and down. But those last few years of caring for her really took a huge toll on him.
Sure.
So it was, but long story here, Joy, but so my mother passes. We find out that my father has cancer, or it has come back is what it was.
Wow.
It had come back, but he hadn't told us. So he hadn't been getting the treatment because he was busy taking care of my mother. Again, things they don't tell you.
Exactly.
So you find this out. Doctors tell us after my mother passes that, you know, my father might make it to Christmas. So this is what we were preparing. So now my brothers and I are preparing ourselves to lose our father as well. And to look at him, you would certainly have believed it. There are some more really tough decisions that now have to be made. He can't be alone. We don't have the right housing situations for him to be living with us. So he has to go to a nursing home. And just praise the Lord. This was the right place for him. He got the rest he needed. He got the schedule of meals and medication he needed. We have the right doctor for him. And he's one of the few people I know who actually left a nursing home to go to his own apartment.
Wow, that's amazing.
It was amazing. He was there for several months. I mean, it was not quick, but they got him to a point where he had gained weight. The chemotherapy was working. There was just things were getting better. And I mean, to every doctor's shock and surprise, my father actually lived nearly 5 years on maintenance treatments. Great. And on his own. He moved to a retirement community so he could go through, you know, the stages if needed.
The channels, yeah.
The channels, mm-hmm. But he had his own apartment. He got to
good
a point
for him.
Of, and where he could still drive and his mind was sharp. And so there was like this little reprieve in the middle of this, which was really strange and odd. And I don't think this is normal, particularly, mm-hmm. especially when they're like, prepare for the worst. To have that, luckily, that gift of a few years. And then, of course, decline again. So now we're back in this decline.
Cycle.
This mm-hmm. cycle, which lasted about a year. And he passed away a year ago, October. So
we're approaching 2 years coming October.
We are approaching 2 years. And with him, it was quicker, obviously, than my mother. And you know, we learned a lot about hospice care and other agencies that are out there, which are just amazing agencies that can do a lot to help you. But, you know, we also had the layer of COVID that prevented us from being with him for quite a bit of that time. We could not go into his retirement community for a long time. So there's just a lot that then, you know, and this is going to happen to a lot of people.
So when your mother passed, mm-hmm. How did you feel? Obviously there's grief, but I mean, how did you feel as far as like, ooh, did you get to take a deep breath and go, wow, okay, the burden has lifted, and you mm-hmm. don't, of course, no one regrets doing what you did.
Right.
But were you like, whew, and then to get the news that dad may need help too, were you just like, oh, I mean, how did you feel? I mean, because I'm sure needed some respite as well.
Yeah, it is important to, like I said, take any opportunity you have to rest, to go away for a day, even just something to break that and to treat yourself well and to just be with friends and family, you know, who are able-bodied and
can
you don't have to take
you.
Care of them, and they love you, and you're just going to, you know, be there.
Obviously, during your dad's cancer journey that he had, you got the call to come here.
Yes.
And so how was that to answer a call to come to Augusta, 2 hours
yeah.
away?
Yeah.
And knowing dad's not doing, and if I make this decision, I'm making a conscious decision.
Right. Well, I'm gonna back up just a little because I think this is hopefully might be helpful to somebody else. But yeah, when my mother passed, you had asked about the grief, but also there is a sense of relief. And there's a sense of guilt that comes with a sense of relief.
Sure.
Because suddenly this dailiness of caregiving is just gone. It's just gone. And part of you is like, oh, you know, you're kind of breathing a little easier. And the other part of you is grieving and misses that person terribly. But there's also some sense of relief. So it is a lot of conflicting emotions at that moment, because you are relieved of those duties of caregiver, but it means you've lost someone you love at the same time. So there's a lot of mixed emotions in there. And so I just tell people, you know, it's not...
Cut yourself some slack.
Right. Expect to feel that relief and not to feel badly that you're a bad person, because you feel relieved of this pressure that has been on you for so long. But to recognize it's all hitting you at one time. I get the call from my brother saying, you know, they're telling me he's not going to live but a few months.
And then you get a job offer in a different city.
And then I get a job offer in a different city. I had, one of the reasons I had not taken, even looked at or considered any other calls for after seminary graduation that weren't local was because of my parents. Like, I can't not be here. So I wouldn't consider anything, even if we were like, hey, we've got this great, we want you to apply. And I'm like, out of the question.
Not right now.
Yeah. Out of the question. This is about as far away as I was
beyond the
go.
2 mile right, or yeah. 2 hour radius right. kind of thing.
I had a radius, and had my other brother not been local, I'm just not sure I even would have done that. But yeah, I had to be close enough that if something happened, I could get home to him in a couple of hours at the most. So yeah, it was a big decision, but my father was always hugely supportive of my ministry. And, you know, it was hard to tell him though, because he was used to me being around, you know.
And he was doing basically well at the time.
He
is
was.
That right?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
So you're thinking, okay, well, this reprieve might last a while and I can explore this call.
Yeah. And I, of course I knew, you know, it's a reprieve. It's going to get worse at some point. There's only so long that this medication is going to work. I talked to him. I said, you know, I'll stay. And he didn't want me to stay. He wanted me to live my life. And I was very grateful for that. He said, you know, go where you're being called. And I was like, you know, well, I'm not going to be far away. And he was very excited. And he was able to actually come visit a couple of times, which I was just so thrilled that he was able to come and see our house and see the church and all of that wonderful stuff. But it was hard. I did feel like I had kind of, you know, abandoned the ship a little bit. But he was at the time, like I said, doing well. He was driving. He was good, you know. Right. And that lasted much longer than anybody thought. So we're certainly grateful for that. And then, you know, as it turned out, my local brother, he had to take on a whole lot.
Team effort there.
Team effort. Yes. Yeah, definitely. Big team
so
effort.
During this journey, which is one that, you know, is a difficult one for sure. And like we've said, it doesn't have the ending that you hope for in some ways, but it does have that ending. Mm-hmm. If you're a believer and your faith is there, obviously they're going to be with the Lord. And so there is some beauty to that. And there is mm-hmm. beauty in that. They're no longer in pain. They're no longer mm-hmm. uncomfortable. And so there's that. So mm-hmm. that's that piece. But during this journey and even after, how do you feel like your faith was shaped or changed in any way?
I think I grew far more empathetic towards just older folks in general. What happens to a life that has been lived fully and to, you know, physically fully, mentally fully, spiritually fully, what happens? And just to realize that, you know, it's not just your life that, you know, your life is affected. Their lives are changed
forever.
And so putting yourself in their place as much as you can, that was huge for me and for my ministry, just to say, yeah, if I was in chronic pain every single day, I'm not going to be the happiest camper in the world every time, you know, somebody comes to see me. You know, you might try your best, but just to take these things with a lot of grace and say, you know what, they're doing the best they can. You're doing the best you can. And just do everything as much as possible with love and just say, you know, and sometimes just admit, you know, this is hard. And let them admit it's hard. Going through this with them was extremely powerful. And it is a gift. It's a hard gift. It's not like you ask for these things to happen. You don't want to see your parents going through these things, or for them to be in pain, or them to feel like, you know, they don't have anything to offer anymore. You know, there's so many difficult times. But just to spend that time with them and to be there as much as you can in whatever capacity you're able to give, that's a gift. And just to be reminded of that, and to remember those moments where you watched Gunsmoke and laughed your heads off, you know, and just thought it was hysterical.
When you found joy in that moment.
Yeah, when you found those moments where something was really funny. I mean, even with my father, when he had the wound that I would say, we would get in stitches about stuff. And it was just so funny. And it was just absurd and ridiculous in this moment. Like, but it was funny. And it really bonded us in a different way,
sure,
than the regular father-daughter bond. It was, you know, it changes the relationship in a lot of ways, but it can make it much stronger and deeper as well.
So would you say, going through this journey that you've been through with your parents, that joy is a choice?
I think so. I mean, you're going to have moments where you're frustrated and you're just like, I just can't get up and do this again. But there's so many moments that are, it's just this, yeah, there, sometimes you're just sitting together in silence, but it's so powerful and it's so meaningful. And there is joy in that. There are joy even in the difficult moments where you recognize that, yeah, the end is coming, but you can be at peace with it together. There's a joy in that too. So there's the joy that's the happy, fun joy. And then there's the joy that's deep, deep, deep. Mm-hmm. And
such a gift.
It is such a gift. And, you know, even if you are able to be with your parent when they pass, that is such a gift. That is such a gift. And it's hard, and not everybody can really go there, but, and that's okay. But if you can, I mean, it's a precious gift.
It really is.
It really is. Yeah.
Well, you are a gift. And I have really enjoyed our time, Nadine, and you are such a wonderful pastor. And one of your greatest gifts is the empathy that you show our congregation of everybody when they're going through a wonderful moment, when they're going through a difficult moment, or just the day-to-day life. And we're so grateful for you. And I'm so thankful that you were here with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And I really enjoyed our time together. Thank you.
As we approach the Lenten season, the 40 days before Easter, not including Sundays, we want to invite you to read Memorial Presbyterian Church for our Lenten season beginning on Ash Wednesday, March the 2nd at 6:30 p.m. Come join us for our Lenten series called Lent in Plain Sight, where we look at the ordinary, simple things that God uses to give us a message during this season of preparation. Join us every second and fourth Wednesday of the month on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, and our website, readchurchaugusta.org.